All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. I'll give you a quick heads up. Calls are starting to come in, but there's room. We're going to do 2 hours today. First hour is the power hour. Second hour, anything goes. The sooner you press one on your phone, the better the chances that you'll get through. If you press one right now, I promise we'll get to you. If you wait much longer, probably not, but I'll keep you updated on that. Let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority, you name it. We'll talk about it. And today is the Power Hour. We're going to take your calls all about engines and performance and fuel mileage and modifications and troubleshooting. And help me out. We've got the guys from Pittsburgh Power, Bruce and John and Ethan. Hey, welcome back, guys.
Thank you for having us, Kevin.
Hey, yeah, I'll get us started today, and then we'll see what's going on in Pittsburgh these days. Bruce, I talked to you a little bit about this yesterday. John, you'll get a kick out of this. There's one group of products that has just kind of been a thorn in my side for almost a little over 10 years now. About 12 years ago, 2005, people started approaching me about hydrogen. And it really looked promising back then when I did all the research. So I tested it many times, really did extensive testing on hydrogen, and we could never get a positive result. Same with propane. I did a couple years ago, right before Louisville, I did a really extensive propane test. We used two trucks, one as a control truck. The company claimed if somebody's not getting a fuel mileage increase out of our system, it's because it hasn't been tuned right. And I said, okay, you have full access to the truck for 30 days. We'll fuel propane and fuel every night at the end of the run. We'll check the mileage, and you can do all the tweaking you want for 30 days. And they did. And at the end of 30 days, our fuel mileage had increased by 6 or 7 tenths. It was pretty significant. But our cost went up 2 cents a mile for the test. When you combine the cost of the fuel and the propane, we were losing money. And that was cheap propane back then. I had a local company deliver it every day. It was the best price you were going to get. Couldn't even come close to that price out on the road. So it would have only been worse in, you know, an over-the-road operation. So right after that, we go to Louisville, and I did this big write-up about it and put all the numbers in, and we showed every fuel up every day. And I'm standing at Louisville, and these five guys walk over and literally surround me. And they are, like, screaming at me, "You're wrong. Our propane system works." They are just going off. And I'm looking at them like, "Guys, I've done the test. It's not working." And they were just yelling. I thought we were going to have a rumble right there on the show floor, because then my listeners started getting behind me, and these guys are surrounding me, and everybody's screaming, and I thought, this is incredible. I don't even know these guys. So that's kind of been the history. One year I had to have somebody stand next to me at Louisville and stop these people from trying to talk to me, because I couldn't talk to anybody else. So that's the history, and I've tried. It just hasn't worked. Yesterday, I'm sitting at home working. My doorbell rings. Nobody hardly ever comes to my house. I thought it was odd. I opened the door, and there two guys are standing there, and they said, "Is this Let's Truck?" And I thought, oh, no. where did these guys come from? So, yeah. And they said, "Do you have time for a cold call?" And I said, "What are you selling?" And they said, "Hydrogen." And I thought, all right, I was bored anyway. Come on in. So all of the same claims. Maybe you guys can help me with this one. Where does this number come from, and where can we find the right number? I know I've read it somewhere, and I know we've talked about this, but every one of these companies claim that we are only burning 90% of the fuel. Where does that number come from? And that makes no sense to me. That basically means for every 1,000 miles you travel down the road, you would have 20 gallons of diesel going out the stack.
Hey, Kevin?
Yeah.
Years ago, when I was designing injector tips for the Big Cam Cummins, and I'm in a meeting in Columbus, Indiana, they brought me into the office, and Mark Apple was heading that up, and Mark is one of the engineers that builds fireboxes now. He said, if you are clear coming out the stack, you are burning 100% of the fuel. Now, if you have smoke coming out the stack, white or black, you are not burning 100%. When we tune a truck, whether it's mechanical or electronic, it's 100% clear. So we are burning 100% of the fuel. I've heard things as low as we're only burning 70%. This is just all hearsay. It's not coming from any of the engineers at Cummins, Cat, Mack, or Detroit. So you burn 100% when the stacks are burning clear.
And that's the first point of contention I have with them, is that that's the first number they always throw out. Well, you're only burning 90% and we're going to help you burn more. And the problem is, if we're already burning most of it, them helping us burn more isn't, if we get 1 or 2% more, how do we burn 1 or 2% more of the fuel but get a 17% increase in fuel economy, which is what they're claiming? And none of them can ever explain that to me. And when I do the math and say, look, if we're only burning 90%, every 1,000 miles we'd be dumping 20 gallons of diesel fuel out the stack. It'd be dripping off the trailer. Then they all look at me like a deer in the headlights, and it just goes downhill from there. They've made some pretty wild claims about their system. One of the things the engineers told me, Bruce, I think you've heard this as well, that the problem with hydrogen on a diesel engine, whether or not hydrogen's ever going to work, I don't know, but they say the problem on a 15-liter diesel engine is the amount of hydrogen you would need is tremendous, and these systems can't produce it. Or if they do, it's going to take so much electricity that you're going to lose the efficiency anyway. And when I talked to them, they said, nope, we don't use plates. We have a whole new technology to produce the hydrogen, hardly uses any electricity, and we produce enough hydrogen that we're testing systems on the giant earth movers down in the mines. Not only are they working to improve fuel economy and clean up emissions, this is their claim. Because the mines underground are short on oxygen, that they claim that in these giant earth movers, they're taking the oxygen that's produced in their system, and it goes in a tube up to the driver to give him extra oxygen. I'm like, okay, that's a new one. They also believe, like, this is the big one. They also believe, they said, and they wanted us to test the system. And I said, look, here's the thing. I've done this so many times, I'm not doing it anymore. And they kept pushing, and I said, look, we'll test it. We're going to charge you. We're not testing for free anymore. It's too time consuming. It hasn't worked in the past. I've heard all these things. So here's another claim of theirs. They said, is it possible? Could you get us an engine, a newer engine without all the emission stuff on it? And I said, well, it's possible. It wouldn't be easy. And it's certainly not going to be cheap. And they said, I said, why? And they said, we believe that if we took a new engine with no emission systems on it whatsoever, our system would pass emissions. And I said, do you realize what you're saying? If that were true, that would be the holy grail of trucking. We wouldn't be millionaires, we'd be billionaires if that were actually true. And that they believe that they could pass all emissions with just their system.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we've done some testing here with hydrogen and propane. A lot of people like to call it, you have to have the sweet spot, or they like to tune it in. We searched for the sweet spot one day for 2 days, on the dyno, never got the truck off idle. Same number kept coming out the stack.
The grant application stuff we did, they all start off with whatever you're applying for cannot defy the laws of physics. And there's a line in the song that says the laws of physics are very strong indeed, and they don't change. Like there's X amount of energy per pound of whatever it is you're burning, and that's all you're going to get out of it, and it's going to create whatever it creates after it burns. And there's just not enough in a pound of hydrogen to do what we needed to do, at least and transport it and make it, you know, to get the kind of power we need out of it.
Well, and Ethan, we're going to test this unit right after Louisville. So, Kevin and I talked yesterday. I didn't tell you guys this yet.
Oh, wait, I got the fuel ionizer guy calling wanting us to do testing too. So yeah, so we could get it all at once. All at once.
Well, Bruce, I just got the email before we went on the air back from the company, and they would do the price.
They agreed?
So, yes, they agreed. So it looks like we will be testing it right after Louisville. So I'm going to get to a break. We'll come back. We'll find out what's new at Pittsburgh Power. We'll get to your calls and questions right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and John and Ethan with me. So I have to give these guys credit, though. They did the hard work, and they're willing to pay for the testing. In fact, I've got another meeting with them tomorrow, and they're going to bring the unit to me, and then I'm going to drive the unit to Louisville and give it to you guys. You know, here's my thought. Really, if you put this thing on and you put it on the dyno, and we don't see any change in horsepower torque. Now, they have numbers. They claim immediate horsepower and torque increases. And my thought is, if you don't see that, why even bother with the emission testing? You're really going to...
Well, Kevin, so far on every one we've tested, and one of them had a 300-amp alternator attached to it. And the unit was the size of a big welder. And it made zero horsepower and torque on the chassis dyno. But we were just talking about using the engine dyno instead. But again, zero on a chassis dyno is going to be zero at the flywheel.
Is this already installed on a truck that you're going to be driving?
It is. Well, they have units installed, and they gave me, you know, their claims and their numbers, and they're talking 17% average fuel mileage increase. But they're going to give me a unit, and you guys are going to put the unit on a truck and then test it so we control. The interesting thing was, and he was adamant about this, and I never asked him why. He kept saying it is going to be a chassis dyno, right? Not an engine dyno. For some reason, they absolutely didn't test it on an engine dyno. They only wanted tested on a chassis dyno.
We can do either, but I don't see why one would get a different result than the other.
It hasn't got like a PTO driven generator or something that needs to be added, does it?
No, they're actually saying that theirs is not using nearly no need for a bigger alternator, which I went through that as well. I had the first system I tested every week I'd come in and my batteries would be dead. So we had to put a bigger alternator on it. And when we put a bigger alternator on it, we actually lost some fuel economy, which makes sense.
Yeah, obviously. Yep.
Yeah. So
we're going to put this on our test truck, our ISX in the Volvo.
We'll put it on the Volvo. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
John, do you want to talk about the seminar you're going to tomorrow?
I'm going to the NACFI meeting in Indianapolis tomorrow. So in the Green Trek Symposium.
I spoke
just
there
gonna
a
run
couple
out
years
for the day.
Yeah, I spoke there a couple years ago. Tell Mike Roth I said hi.
Well, I've not been to it before. Steve Krohn invited me, got me, you know, credentials, and I'm gonna just drive out tonight, spend the day there tomorrow, and come back tomorrow night and check that out. The show's there too, the NTEA show, and they've got their green truck thing going on now too. I'm gonna take a walk through that as well in the morning, and then the NACFI conference starts at noon. So I'll walk the show for the morning, and then I'll do the NACFI conference and see what we can see after that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did that a couple of years ago. They had the same thing. They had the Green Truck Conference going on, so I went through that, and then I spoke at NACFI. There's some really interesting people there because NACFI's made up. It's almost a kind of a pseudo nonprofit kind of thing. So they've got, you know, it was made up of like some of the head engineers from the engine manufacturers and tire companies. Michelin's involved. UPS was involved. A lot of, really high-level companies have put money into it. So it was interesting. I got to talk to a lot of interesting people the year that I was there. So I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to some of them about our new product with the Soot Cyclone there. We're still producing results with the unit that's on the PACCAR. I called the guy last week to see if he'd noticed a difference in DEF consumption, which is really turning me on more than the increased fuel mileage we're seeing, but we're seeing that as well. But the, the first truck we did saw about a 30% decrease in DEF consumption, which has nothing to do with the cost of DEF. But to me, that means we're making 30% less NOx, because the NOx sensor tells the DEF pump how much DEF to spray into the decomp tube. So that means the engine, and we're seeing lower EGTs as well, so which also lends itself to less NOx. So I'd like to talk to some of the people around the conference there about that, and maybe get some more testing done, or talk to them about just introduce myself and let them know what we're up to.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, like I say, I think you'll really enjoy it. There are some interesting people involved in that group. So what else you guys got going on?
Hello, what do you got?
Oh, Ethan? I think we better take some questions right now. We're going to run out of time here soon.
let's do that then. Let's get started right there in Pennsylvania. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Ethan and Bruce. I heard you guys talking, I think it was 2 weeks ago, about a cat you guys rebuilt a year ago. And he came back and he had high blow by, and you guys dynoed it, and you found him. I think it was a Jake brake seal or something wrong with it.
It wasn't high blow by, it was high oil consumption. And it looked, the oil was coming out of the blow by tube. And it was a seal up in the overhead there for the Jake brake, I believe. And it was squirting right onto the little shield that's supposed to keep that from happening. But being it was shooting directly on it, it was still working its way out the blow by tube.
So was it a cracked Jake housing? It was spraying right at the.
Yeah, another ring.
O-ring.
Yeah, it blew out on it.
Okay, my question was, because I got a 12.7 Detroit and a glider, and it's been, it has a reman in it already, the second time, and I got high blow by coming out of the tube, and I had it dynoed, and it's only getting 2 inches of, it's only showing 2 inches of crankcase pressure, but I'm not burning no oil or anything. So I was wondering, maybe could it have a bad ring, a ring broke in one of the cylinders, or could it be something else? Could it be something simple?
How many miles are on it? The reman.
On this reman, right? Yeah, on the reman, it's like 375.
Okay. Could be a couple things. It may not just be.
Well, you'd see higher. You just have a lot of oil coming out of the tube.
No, actually, I don't really have hardly any coming out of the tube. It's just, you can just say you're sitting idle, you can just see, all the smoke blowing out of it, man.
Make sure your air compressor is not compressing the crankcase.
Okay, how you do that?
I don't know how you'd test that.
That's a good one.
It could be the rings on the compressor, too.
Yeah, because it could be backfeeding.
If you've only got 2 inches of on the manometer, that really shouldn't be visible? What's the upper limit on a Detroit? Four?
Three.
Three, okay.
Yeah, so three's the limit on it.
Two-thirds of the way there.
But you should see oil consumption.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not burning any. No, not at, I mean, I can go 20,000 miles without adding a drop.
Okay.
Makes me think that there's
something else wrong. Yeah, check the compressor, or it idles. It's got nothing to do with boost. But that would be about it.
I just don't want to, you know, go ahead and tear the head off of it, man, and it could be something else that's the last.
Oh, I wouldn't. Yeah, you know, don't let that have you pull the head off. If the thing's running good and you just because you see some vapors down there, I wouldn't worry about that at all. You know, run it until you get to the 3 inches of blow by, and then it'll need rings at that point. But it's probably going by the rings, I think. What you're seeing there.
Okay. So basically, run it until it gets up to around 3 inches, and then
yeah,
go ahead, maybe yank it apart.
And at that point, yeah, the cylinder kits will need.
You know, years ago, I turbocharged a Chevy Suburban with an Isuzu diesel, and it was a 5.7 liter, and it had a 1-inch diameter blow-by tube, and that thing would just huff white smoke out, and it did not have blow-by, and it did not have consumption. So don't worry about a little bit of white smoke coming out of a breather.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that either.
Hey, Bruce, did you get the pictures of the ISX I sent you?
When did you send it?
Sent him an email yesterday, maybe, day before. Let me look, see when I sent it.
Send them to me.
Yeah, it's two pictures of the top end, and there's a bunch of rust.
Kevin, I wasn't on the email last night. I was returning phone calls till 10 p.m. as I was out of the office yesterday. I'm out of the office right now, so I'll see it this afternoon.
Got it. I'll send it over to John right now. I had this call the other day on the air, but I didn't have the pictures when I was on the air. So I've got it now. John, I just sent it to you. We'll get to another call while you're looking at that. Let's go to New Jersey. Joe, well, hey, Joe, hold on. I just looked at the clock and we're coming up on a break. So I'll take us into the break. And when we get back, we'll get right to some calls and questions. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. We've always got something new going on over there. Our store has got some awesome products in there. We are really working hard to get in really good food items on the road. Right now, we have some of the best beef sticks you have ever tasted, and they're crazy healthy. Our monkey brittle will be back in stock today. I'm heading that way to get another batch. We can't keep that stuff in stock. And all of our new nut butters are in there as well. Check those all out. Letstruck.com. We'll be right back. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and John and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power with me, and we're going to head off to New Jersey. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Hope everyone's doing well. I've got some questions here on transmission and gear ratios. So I'm looking at a 99 Eagle, or International Eagle, with an N14 Cummins 435. It has 390 rears, and right now it has a 9-speed direct transmission.
Let me tell you.
Okay, it only runs 64 miles an hour.
With a direct and 390s, you would have a hard time doing 40 miles an hour. So it's definitely not a double overdrive, as a matter of fact, or maybe a single, but I kind of doubt it with 390s. But it's definitely not direct.
Well, it was changed out, and the guy that has it says he believes they put the wrong transmission in it, and he has a 9-speed over that he says he would put in it. My big question is, with 390s, would a 9-speed with a overdrive be a good transmission, or should I look for a 13-speed? Or would they be the same final ratio?
Where are you going to operate?
I run usually east of the Mississippi. My weight is usually no more than 60, 65,000 pounds. Half the time I'm almost empty. But even my lightweight is 48,000 pounds.
I don't think that's the right truck for you.
Okay.
I wouldn't be looking at that truck. 390 rears, if you're going to stay like up in New England and you're going to haul heavy and just stay in the mountains, then that's okay. But what you're doing, that's wrong. That's not a good combination.
Well, just to give you an idea, if this truly were 390s and a direct transmission at 65 miles an hour, you would be at 2,300 RPM.
Right. He said it's at 2,200 at 64 miles an hour.
I'll take that back then. That is a direct drive. Whoever put it in there should be shot.
Right. Well, that's what we were thinking. But I didn't know that if by switching it to an overdrive or a 13 speed would be the thing to do.
Well, I mean, you've got to go with the double overdrive. You've got to get a final gear ratio down to 0.73 or 0.74. And if you did that and you're willing to drive slow enough, this may work. Let me just do this at a 0.73 real quick. With a 0.73 at 65 miles an hour, you'd be at 1665, which is a little high. If you're willing to run this truck at 60, it puts you at about 1525, which for an N14 isn't bad. That's doable. But you're just not going to want to drive this truck much faster than 60.
Okay, that's not where I want to be, because I like to run closer to 70.
Oh, yeah, you do not want 390 gears to run around at 70 miles an hour. Now, at 55, this truck would get awesome fuel economy. At 55 miles an hour, that's about as good as you would ever get out of the N14. So if you're willing to drive it around 55 to 60, you get incredible fuel economy. But other than that, and that's as deep as you can go on the overdrive. So that's as good as it's going to get with 390s.
If I did a rear swap out, what would be the way to go? 355 or lower?
Well, no.
264. I'd put 264s and run it in direct.
Yep.
That's what I'd do.
And it is.
And that's with which?
Is direct.
With a 13 speed or leaving in?
Leave that 9 speed direct.
Leave the 9 Brucey's speed and put 264 gears?
Yeah, that's the cheapest way to make this a very drivable truck, because you've already got the 9-speed direct. It's already in there. Leave it in there. Put in 264s, and you're all set.
And then what type of speed do you think that would run at? This engine should run at, what, about 1,500?
1,500 isn't bad on an N14. If you were to put 264s. Let me run some numbers real quick.
I'm sorry, Bruce, what's that?
What size tire?
20 Lowpro 24.5.
Okay.
Yeah, so you could run 65 with 264s at right at about 1525. So that's definitely doable on that truck.
All right, so if you're running 70, you'd be close to 1600 or 16 and a quarter?
Yeah, you're going to be 16 plus at 70.
Okay. All right, but and changing out rears is less expensive than the tranny.
No, absolutely.
Not necessarily. But, I don't know. I think you're still going to spend about $8,000 to change your rears.
Okay.
Well, then that's about the transmission. Yeah. Bruce, I must be falling behind. I keep saying 4 to 5 for a set of rears.
Yeah, no, you're falling behind. Prices are skyrocketing on truck parts.
Got it.
Keep in mind, the OEMs have to make up for the loss of what they've taken, the beating they've taken on the emissions engine since 2003. So everything's going up at an alarming rate. But then again, you still have a miserable 9-speed where you can't split a gear. So
True. Even
with the 264s, yeah. I would rather have the 13 or the 18 because I like to split a gear. And if you're going to run in the east, you're in a lot of rolling hills, you're in traffic, you're in construction, and you need to be able to split that gear. So
yeah,
that's
would
not a good combination.
Yeah, I agree.
Spend $20,000 on this truck. You're going to spend 20 grand or more to make this truck right.
Let's head off to Missouri. Dwayne, welcome to the program.
Yes, I have a 1996 Freightliner with a 12.7 Detroit, and I have got a coolant problem. I'm losing coolant. I do have some coolant coming out of my overflow tube, and I don't run my tank full. I run it about halfway in the tank. But if I shut the engine off overnight, I would have to add coolant to it the next morning. So it seemed like my coolant is going somewhere, but it's not leaking other than coming out of my overflow tube when I'm running. I've had this problem one time before, and it turned out to be a broken head bolt. And this was like 2 years ago. And the day before it started leaking out of my exhaust, I developed a hydro lock on the engine. And I thought my battery was low. And somebody said, no, it hydro locked on you. Then the next day it started leaking out of my exhaust. And that's when I got into the shop and found out it was a broken head bolt.
So have you pulled the valve cover to look at the head bolts?
No, I have not had it in an engine shop to have that done yet. I am at T&E Tire in Kansas City. They're doing some suspension work for me because they don't do mechanical
Have them pull the valve cover and take a punch or a chisel and a hammer and tap each bolt. And if one of the head bolts turns, you know you got a broken head bolt.
Yeah.
I think you either have a cracked head or a blown head gasket. But.
Yeah. Hey, easier than that, have them leave. Just have them do a bubble test on it. They could. They should have a little funnel adapter that goes into the top of the coolant fill and fill it up, and then fire the engine up and watch for compression making its way back into the cooling system. You'll see bubbles if that's the case, because you've got hundreds of psi of compression pressure there, as opposed to the 15 of coolant pressure. So if they just start the engine, warm is better than cold, and watch for bubbles in the coolant. If you're only running your expansion tank half full and you're still pushing coolant out, I've got to believe that you're putting compression into the cooling system, which leads to a head gasket or a cracked head.
That'll do it for that segment. The music's playing. I've got to get to a break. We've got one more. We're going to come back and get to your calls and questions right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and John and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power with me. John, did you get those pictures, the email?
I did. Yeah, that looks like just some rust from condensation. The oil, it may have sat for a little while or been used on short trips and then sat a little while in between, and you heat the crankcase up and cool it, and you end up with condensation inside. And whatever oil they're running, it looks like it, you know, the engine's awfully clean inside, aside from that rust. But I've seen other ISXs with the same, exactly a little bit of rust on top of the rockers like that before. So I don't think it's anything particular to worry about. But is the person who owns this truck owned it its whole life, or is it something that they just bought, or do they know the history of it?
No, I think they just got it recently, if I remember right. And I recommended they just pull an oil sample so we could see what might be going on in there.
Yeah, I've seen this before. It looks to me like it just sat. The engine's awfully clean inside. There's no, it looks good. But,
yeah, that's what I thought.
And you see
too.
It's all up high, right? So where the oil would have run off first. So evidently there wasn't enough oil film to protect it from the condensation.
That makes sense. All right. Let's see. Yep. We are off to Arkansas. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for being able to get to my call. I had phone troubles there before the show started. I didn't know if I'd get in on the Power Hour.
Well, we've got you. Go ahead.
What I have is I currently have a 2012 Mack Pinnacle that's running the basically D13 Volvo motor in it. And I'm thinking about to invest in the truck to keep it for several years of swapping the motor out for a non-emissions motor. And the information I've been able to find so far is that I can't do that because it would make the truck a glider kit truck. And I'm wondering what you guys would have to say about me doing a motor swap like that in this truck.
Well,
you're going
it
to do the labor sense. Yourself.
Bruce, hold on just a second.
Say again.
First off, let's clear something up. It doesn't make it a glider. A glider is a very specific item. It's manufactured by the OEM without an engine. The serial number even designates it as a glider. So whoever is using that terminology is just going to confuse everything. What the reason you can't switch out the engine is because it has nothing to do with a glider. It has to do with the fact that you're modifying the emissions, and that's illegal. When you take the engine out, obviously you're modifying all of the emissions, and that's the illegal part. So get rid of the whole glider, because that's just going to confuse everybody. Bruce, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what was confusing me about it, is that's what I understood a glider to be. But go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah.
So you're going to pull out, you say this is a Mack, but it has the Volvo engine?
It's labeled as MP8, but all the...
Mack and Volvo are owned by the same company now, Bruce. So a lot of the parts are becoming interchangeable. It's still called as a Mack engine.
Okay. Next question. What engine are you going to put in it?
I was wanting to put in a Detroit 60 series.
Let me tell you what you're going to be up against. When you do a swap like that, you're going to have about a month of labor. So you're going to buy $20,000 worth of labor plus parts plus the engine. You're looking at about a $40,000 to $50,000 conversion here.
Oh, wow.
And you're going to be down for a month. So can you take a month downtime plus all that? Engine swaps today are very complicated because of the electronics. It's not like when we did the mechanical engines and yanked them. One out and yanked out a Cummins and put a 4 1/4 B cat in or something. Today it's very expensive to do.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna, if I decided to go forth with it and it seemed like a cost effective approach with trying to get around this emission stuff for reliability, I was going to take a month vacation, about month and a half vacation while it was getting done, but it's going to cost $40,000 to $50,000. It'd just be easier to buy a new truck.
That's right. exactly right.
I
would advise you not to try to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep. Thanks for the call. Let's squeeze in a couple more before we've got to get out of here. Let's head off to Missouri. Edward, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. On the 17th, I had finally had to go into this Series 60 and put in two injectors. Actually, it wasn't running bad. It was just leaking, number one and number six. And it's a 2007. I'm about 10,000 from a million miles on it with 27,000 hours. And so when they done that, 24 hours later, I had a tow truck on me. And so went into Freightliner. They found a couple of wires on the ECM head rubbed against a clamp. And so a week later after that, I had another tow truck. So they finally figured out I needed an entire new engine harness wiring. And so after that, when I hit my jake brakes, my engine light come on, and they kind of they act kind of funny, you know, when they start up slow and then they go ahead and speed on up. And so that's what I'm calling to see if I'm actually, my bucket list is just to come to you guys. I'm not spending more money on these other shops. So I'm just trying to figure out what is probably causing that check light to come on when the engine brakes come on.
If the wiring harness had a pin swapped, the one that goes to the check engine light, or something isn't correct in the wiring, and it could be the reason, too, that the jakes aren't working properly.
Okay.
Do you know what the code is?
Actually, I don't know.
Code? Okay.
Yeah, they had to change out the whole engine wiring harness, and I was just wondering if it had anything to do with it.
And if it just started after they did that, I would think it does.
Yeah, you always look in the last place you worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
For the problem.
All right. It's always something.
But they'll have to pin that hard wire.
I say that again.
They have that harness checked. It could pin what they call pin out the harness, make sure everything's going where it belongs. There could be a pin swap somewhere, or as configurable the Detroit ECMs are, I mean, some of them are a little bit different.
Okay.
So I'm not, I don't know that, you definitely gotta look at that harness, I think, that was just put on there.
Okay. All right.
I know what the code is.
All right.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to, where are we going this time? Oh, looks like we just dropped a whole bunch of calls. Must be sunspots or something. Let's go.
EMP.
Georgia. Welcome. Yeah, it was an EMP. We better watch out. Steve, go ahead.
Now, I had a general question for you in the second hour.
I'm here now, and we only have a couple minutes. Let's go ahead and do it.
Okay. I was up under a U.S. Express lease program in 2015, and I made lease payments, and I went in and made a balloon payment to pay it off, and they sent me an Oklahoma title, and I was wondering, do I have, because I'm getting my authority, do I have to file that and pay taxes on that balloon payment or the lease payments that I paid towards the lease to get it exchanged from Georgia, or should I get my tag in Oklahoma?
Okay, it sounds to me like we're confusing two issues here. We're confusing income tax and deductions with sales tax and titling the vehicle. So I'm not sure which question I should answer.
Well, I'm looking at the sales tax side of it.
Okay. So if you were able to title it in Oklahoma, that would be a good thing because Oklahoma doesn't charge sales tax on commercial vehicles. The problem is, unless you have an address in Oklahoma, you're not going to be able to title it.
Okay. Okay.
So where
if I have to pay the sales, Georgia.
And Georgia does charge sales on commercial vehicles. So I believe you're going to have to pay the sales tax to Georgia when you title it.
Okay, what do I pay it on? The lease payments that I've made or the balloon payment that I made?
The balloon payment, which is also how you will handle this for income tax. So your lease payments were deducted as you made them. The balloon payment is
right.
considered purchase of the vehicle. So when you make the balloon payment and the title gets signed over to you, that's like you bought it. So we actually take the balloon payment and we depreciate it on the tax return, the income tax return. And then that is also the amount that you will pay sales tax on. That is what becomes the purchase price, was the balloon payment. With that, I've got to get out of here. There's the music. Thanks to John and Ethan and Bruce from Pittsburgh Power. And we'll do it again next week. Be safe. Be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, so a quick heads up. We're going to, we have a ton of calls, but hardly any questions. In fact, I don't have enough questions to get me through another hour, but I'm going to go ahead and start. So if you want to get in, go ahead and press one on your phone right now. And I'll either just keep going till I get to everybody's questions, or we'll do another full hour. It's up to you. So here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority, you name it. We'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call. And I'm going to get right into the phone calls tonight, see how many we can get to. Let's start off in Texas. Mac, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me on. You should have my spreadsheet there from Bridget.
I've got it here in front of me. Go ahead.
All right. So I'm looking at doing a startup here as an owner-operator. I've been around trucks for a while, but I've never been an owner-operator. But this is my first whack at throwing some numbers on paper and kind of seeing what I'd be up against. And I just kind of wanted you to take a look at it and see if anything jumped out as way out of whack.
All right, got it. So one of the first things I was looking for here, so I've got up at the top, I've got the expected revenue per mile, which is excellent. I have all the costs that you're projecting. I'll look through those in a second. What I was looking for, though, is there somewhere that shows me what the net would be based on these numbers?
Yeah, the what, big number at the top in the middle. That it's actually in parentheses. It's actually negative because it's a cost sheet. So that would be a cost savings. That would be total profit at the end of the year. Does that make sense?
Sort of. Where's what number
under annual,
is that?
6700, 670502.
Why am I not seeing that
highlighted?
Anymore?
It says right on the very top, 10th. I don't know if you've got it in Excel or not, but it's on the bottom line, annual. Shows
is it highlighted in yellow?
Yes.
Is the, oh, for some reason in the version I got, all I see is a big yellow block. I can't see any numbers in there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no.
Okay. All right. So let's
now that's after driver pay and everything.
Now, it looks to me like you're estimating numbers with your own authority. Is that correct?
The one that you've got right now, no. There is no authority. Yeah, I'll be leasing on.
Okay, so
I'll be a lease driver on this one.
Got it. So one of the numbers I see here, 12,000 for insurance, way too high. You're never going to pay anywhere near that being leased to a carrier. You would pay that and actually a little more than you had your own authority. Because when you have your own authority, you've got to get your own primary liability and you have to get cargo insurance. And with a carrier, you don't need either one of those. All you need with a carrier is some sort of deadhead, bobtail, unladen liability. There's a couple different policies. Those are pretty cheap. And the comprehensive coverage on the truck, and if you're only paying $25,000 for the truck, your insurance isn't going to be very high at all. So that's a number that you could adjust. Now, I'm just, when I first look at a spreadsheet here on the air, it's hard for me to kind of...
I can imagine. They're always in different formats. And
yeah, real quick here, I'm trying to... What is the number I'm seeing here on the first page? The 6,313 for fuel. Is that a month?
Let's see. Where are you?
First page. You have startup costs, and there's fuel in under startup cost. What's that for?
Oh, that's okay. So that's basically a so I don't have to factor loads or anything like that. So that's basically just a starting fuel
just cash flow.
So that I don't have to.
Got it.
Yep.
Got it. All right. Fuel 37,800. How did you calculate your fuel cost?
Basically, that's based off of... if you look at the very top, you could actually, I don't know if you have a different version or what you're looking at, and you can actually play with some of these numbers, but there's 6.5 miles to the gallon at 240 a gallon, based off of getting a annual 102,600 miles in a year. So that's where that annual number comes off, and then it's broken down from there.
Okay. That's pretty close. Then the other one I see. Yeah, I'm only seeing 5,000 for maintenance. That would, on 100,000 miles, that would only be 5 cents a mile. That's low.
Okay. Now, keep in mind, I'm starting with a $10,000 account in the startup cost. There's 10,000 set aside for maintenance, and then from there, I'll continue to add 5,000 a year.
Okay, got
it. But do you think even on an annual basis, I'll need to add more than that?
15,000, the 10 and the 5 would work. I was going to say at least double the 5. You're going to spend at least $10,000 in maintenance, about 10 cents a mile, roughly. And that's a well-tuned, well-running truck. If we get one of those problem trucks, that number can go way up. But at 10 cents a mile, so you'd be looking at roughly $10,000 to $12,000 for the first year, instead of the, like I say, when I saw 5 in here and I didn't see the other 10. Other than that, I think the numbers are good. And here's the other thing I can tell you. I mean, it's always good to do an exercise like this. It gets you familiar with the numbers. This is good to do. I can tell you this: if we can generate $1.50 a mile in revenue, there's no reason you can't be profitable. So some people come to me and they want to crunch every single number, and it's a good exercise. So go do it. The odds of your operation actually looking like this, slim to none, will be close on some numbers. But the real bottom line is, if you can go out and generate $1.50 a mile in revenue, then we can make money. I mean, if I were generating $1.50 a mile in revenue, I'd be shooting to keep 70 or 75 cents of it myself. And that's certainly doable if we control expenses. So, yeah, I think your numbers are good.
Okay. So on $1.50 a mile, is that pretty reasonable with today's rates? I mean, I haven't taken any time yet really to sit down and dig through rates and lanes and really see, but from what I'm hearing from friends in the industry, $1.50 is probably decent and doable.
It's doable, but there are the vast majority of carriers you would lease to, you would not make $1.50, especially now with fuel prices where they are. You're going to have to, if you look at mileage contracts, nobody's paying $1.50. So you're going to have to look at a percentage contract. And then the issue always is percentage of what? I mean, we have to know what their freight rates are. If they're moving a bunch of garbage and we're on percentage, you're not going to make $1.50 a mile. So I think if anything, if you're going to use these numbers, finding that $1.50 a mile is going to be your biggest challenge being leased to a carrier.
Okay.
It can be done, no question, but it's not even the average. The average lease to a carrier is actually less than that right now, probably more like the $1.30 range, because most mileage contracts with fuel surcharge are paying $1. And then fuel surcharges isn't that big right now. So you got a lot of guys in the $1.20 a mile range being leased to a carrier. So $1.50 can be done, but don't just assume that that's a slam dunk, that you're just going to go out, sign on with somebody and get $1.50 a mile. You're going to have to look for it and work for that rate.
Okay. All right. Well, so I've got insurance and maintenance, and then I'll adjust my mileage and see where I go from there.
Yeah. And like I say, the way to simplify this really is if you can get the $1.50 a mile, then you can be profitable, very profitable. It's a great exercise to do these kind of numbers. But in reality, again, I can simplify this. If you get that rate, the rest is just a matter of controlling your expenses. So it's not, you know, it's really not a mystery, or we're not trying to guess whether or not you can be profitable. On $1.50 a mile, you can. So your focus should be, how do I set up my operation to get that $1.50 a mile? The other thing that can screw you up is you're calculating that $1.50 a mile on all miles. That means you've got to get an average rate more like about $1.60 a mile, because you figure deadhead and going back and forth to the shop and miles you're not getting paid for. And so your calculation is on $1.50 a mile, all miles. You've actually got to get a higher rate than that to make that work. Stick around. We'll be right back. We'll get to more of your calls and questions right after this. Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We are off to Indiana. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What can I help?
I'm driving a 2000 Mack day cab with 24.5-inch tires, and it's a 6-speed transmission. The first question is, it's got a tag axle. And they told me that if the pressure on the tag axle gets above like 40, anywhere from 45 to 60, I've heard varying things, that I need to drop the tags so that I can be legal. Is there any way, looking at that pressure on the tags, whether with them up or down, to tell how much weight I've actually got on the drives without scaling it?
The only way I know is with one of the products like the Right Way scales that you install on the vehicle itself. And they're pretty simple. They're not that expensive. There are some analog versions rather than digital. And the analog version, all they're really doing is they plumb into the airbag itself. Then there's a gauge, and the gauge is calibrated so that the pressure in the airbag equates to the weight on the axle. So when you first install them, you do take it to a scale and you calibrate, you know, if we're at this much pressure in the airbag, it equals this much weight on the axle. And that way, then anytime you just walk back, you look at the gauge and you can tell how much weight you have on each axle. That's the only way I would know how to do it.
The reason I ask is there's been a couple of times where I've put the tags down and I was still at like 45 or 50 PSI on the drives. And I mean, it was heavy. And I don't generally scale because it's in local operation. And there's really only one scale that I ever go past. And that's in Cincinnati, up the Cincinnati, Ohio line, or Ohio, Indiana line. And it's never open.
Yeah.
But I was just kind of curious. You know, and then the second quick question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say again, I don't know of any way you could do it just based on the gauge you have, unless you were able to go take the time and sit at a scale and calibrate it and come up with a chart and say, and that would just be a lot of work. And I'm not sure how accurate it would be after that. But if it's not a problem, if you're not hitting any scales and this hasn't been an issue, I don't know that I would do anything about it. Like I say, the one solution would be to install like the Right Way scales, and then you'd just be able to look at a gauge and know what your weight was on each axle.
Okay. Second question then would be, with it being a 6-speed and 24.5-inch tires, I don't know what my rear end is. At 60 miles an hour, I'm at about 1550
the problem
RPM.
Here, I'm not going to be able to calculate the rear end ratio because I don't know the final transmission ratio on that 6-speed. I'm not familiar with that transmission at all. I actually had one many, many years ago. I built a little city tractor, a Ford, and I put a 6-speed in it, but I don't remember what the final, and you may not have the same 6-speed, so I'd only be guessing, but if I don't know the final ratio on the transmission, there's no way for me to calculate the rear end ratio. I've got to have three of the four numbers. I need speed, RPM. Oh no, four of the five numbers. I need speed, RPM, tire size, and either transmission or rear end. And then I can, if I have four of the five, I can always calculate the fifth. If I only have three, which is all I have here, I can't. I need that fourth number to be able to calculate it. Let's go to Ohio. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've got two questions for you. One, I'm getting ready to get my own authority. I'm buying a truck. We're working on it now. My question is, I'm not going to be putting it on the road until probably August or September, but I'm not real sure whether I should do a sole proprietor or an LLC. I'm not sure exactly which way I should be going on that. I'm going to be putting it on my own authority, but I'm going to be contracted to a company hauling their freight, pulling their trailer.
Well, wait a minute. You're going to have to explain that arrangement to me because I'm not sure how that's going to work. You can't lease to another carrier when you have your own authority.
Well, no, I'm not leasing to them. It's just it runs through them, kind of like they're a brokerage side.
Okay, so they do have brokerage authority, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's critical. If all they have is carrier authority, then you can't do this. If they have broker authority, then you're not really leased to them or anything else. They are just brokering freight to you.
Right. Yeah, that's the way they do their, well, they've got lease operators, then they got contract operators, and all their contract operators run through the brokerage side.
Brokerage side. Okay. And then that's fine. I would, since you're, you know, normally I say we only incorporate when there is a tax reason to do it, and that's when we make a certain amount of money, and we don't know that here yet. But the other time I say you should start as an S-Corp, and you can be an LLC taxed as an S-Corp, either one, I would do that because of the authority. Because the odds are, if we do this right, you're going to make enough money that we're going to need the corporation anyway. And with the authority, I don't want to wait to see and then have to change everything on the authority as well. So if we know somebody's going to start with their own authority, then I just say do the S Corp right up front.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got one other question about the truck I'm building. It's a 99 Freightliner Century, not my first choice, but it's got a N14 with a RTO 167 09A 13 358 rears.
Okay.
And I bought the truck, but the engine blowed up, spun a bearing, took out the cam. So I bought a 97 Volvo that had an N14 in it, and truck was wrecked. It had been sitting for a long time. Took the engine out. I'm having to change everything over on the front of the engine and everything, but I took the oil pan off, had to switch it around. Everything looks nice and clean in the bottom. Rods and mains look good. Took the valve covers off, and I had surface rust on the top of the center head valve cover and on the Jake rack. Would that just, do you think that would just be condensation or something, or should I dig it in deeper before I put this thing on the road? But the bottom, looking up from the bottom, the liners look good. Everything, like I said, rods and mains look good.
I have a feeling this is just condensation and rust from it sitting, if it's up in the top end only. I don't think that's any big deal.
Okay. All right. That's what I was wondering about. I didn't want to go any deeper if I didn't have to right now until I run it for a couple of thousand miles and get an oil sample on it.
Yeah, I think once we get it, and here's the thing, that N14's a rock solid engine. That's just a workhorse. They last forever, drop dead simple to work on. So that's always a great choice for a truck. There's just not a lot of risk in owning that engine.
Okay, I've got one more question for you on that truck, if you've got a second.
Sure, go ahead.
That thing, it's got 11 R22.5s on it. I know it come out with the low pros. I'm not real happy with the 11 R's, but they're brand new Michelins. And I'm not sure how that thing's going to gear out with those 11 R's on it. I'm not sure why the guy put them on there before I bought it. Would it be too high a range for that with that 13? Should I look at changing now to 11 R's? I mean, to low pros and getting rid of the trading in the 11 R's?
You know which Michelin is on there? What model?
No, not right offhand. I don't. I've got it wrote down. I had it with me.
So here's what I would say. Michelin has a couple tires that, as far as rolling resistance, are just horrible. Like their XDA5 is awful for rolling resistance. So to answer your question, it would come down to the rolling resistance, because to me, that's more important than the size. If it's got a good low rolling resistance tire on there, I would leave it. The difference between an 11R and a Low Pro is not that big. If fuel prices were at $5 a gallon, we might get nitpicky about that size. But at today's fuel price, if you've got a good tire on there and it's got a good low rolling resistance, I would just keep it. Because I don't think that it's going to be a problem at all at today's fuel price. But if it's a high rolling resistance and the wrong size, then that would be enough. I would change it. So it would come down to that number. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Hey, everybody, give me 1 minute. I've got to go grab something real quick, and then I'll come back. We'll get started. Hold on. All right, here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're the website, letstruck.com. Check it out. If you haven't been there, we're always adding stuff. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. I'm going to head off to Minnesota. Gary, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Kevin. Say, I'm the one that called in last week about getting two book recommendations for my stubborn mother or whatever, and the book should actually be at my doorstep today when I get home, so I'll be able to deliver them to her. But my other question is I have somebody that is just bound and determined to get her gallbladder taken out because she has a gallbladder stone, and that's what the doctors are recommending, whatever. So I was wondering, is there a good book that explains what happens to the gallbladder when it's not, you know, if you use it, if you're not using it, you lose it, and what causes the gallbladder stones or anything that would help her, you know, change her mind?
Yeah, you know, I haven't found a book of good gallbladder health yet that I really like. I keep looking for one myself. What I recommend to people, though, and she may or may not be open to doing this, you know, you can only try to help somebody so much.
Yeah, especially when she loves pasta.
Yeah, exactly. I have been recommending when people because here's part of the problem. If the gallstones really flare up and cause inflammation and cause fever and the other problems, that can technically be life-threatening. So we never want to mess around with that. And if we have a doctor saying you need surgery, then what I usually recommend is find a naturopath. A naturopath, and I won't even really intervene as an NTP here. My recommendation as an NTP is, look, I can get your gallbladder healthy long term if you're willing to make the dietary changes, but I can't deal with this emergency situation short term. So I recommend a naturopath.
The way I'm understanding it, it's not even an emergency. She's got a gallbladder stone or whatever, and it's a little bigger, so they can't laser it to make it, you know, that's what she was saying anyway, but their recommendation is just take the whole gallbladder out. I said, well, why can't they just take the stone out, leave the gallbladder?
And that's why I like to get a naturopath involved, because the naturopath has the medical credentials to make that call, whether or not this is life-threatening, could turn life-threatening if surgery really is necessary. I always want somebody with medical credentials to make that determination. And then if the naturopath were to say, well, no danger here, you could leave it. Here's some things we can do to try to shrink it or eliminate it. And then we work to get the gallbladder healthy. I like to have that medical opinion that says they're not in any danger. And then we could move on to the strategies for making it healthy. But they've got to be willing I mean, if they're just sitting there saying the doctor said it's coming out, I want it out, you know, there's just not a whole lot you can do other than try to, you know, you can find articles all over the internet on, you know, gallbladder stuff and people's experience. People are unhealthy after they lose their gallbladder. And then they really have to be willing to change their dietary habits and take supplements. And most people won't. And I can tell you, she will have health problems if that gallbladder comes out.
Yep. She this is what's crazy. She's got a son that's already had his gallbladder out, a daughter that's got her gallbladder out, and I think her dad's got her gallbladder out. So she's thinking it's just hereditary, you know. And I'm saying, no, it's diet. I said diet is hereditary.
Exactly. Yeah. They are certainly putting a bunch of doctors' kids through college.
Yep. Yep, exactly. So no more.
Yeah, so I really, when we have issues like this, just to be on the safe side, I really want to get a medical opinion about, is it safe to just work on the gallbladder the way it is, or does something else have to be done before we start doing that? And, you know, kudos for trying to help people. Some people just aren't willing and they're just not ready. Let's go to Illinois. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
Hold on 1 second. I can barely hear you. Yep. Yeah, try that.
Can you hear me now?
There you go. That's better.
Let me do this. Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I'm having an interesting fetal issue with my 2005 780 Volvo. I've got an ISX on it with the Dasco fuel filter on it. I've changed the breathers in both things.
You're fading out again. Hey, we're going to have to do something on the volume.
I'm going to switch it to my phone.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
That is so much better.
How's that?
There we go. Now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I have the ISX truck. I have the Davco fuel filter. I've changed both breathers in both tanks. And I'm drawing more fuel from the left tank than I am the right tank. And I hold 275 gallons of fuel. And weather changes the draw from that tank too. As it gets colder, it gets worse. And when it's warmer, it's a little bit better. I'm not sure what else to check.
You know, this is an interesting issue. And I've been dealing with this since I've been on the air. And it's one, believe it or not, it's one of the more complicated issues. Every time I deal with somebody on this, it turns out to be something different. It's breathers, it's crossover tubes, it's valves, it's junctions, it's return fuel flow. Sometimes we think it's only pulling from one tank when it turns out it's pulling from both, only returning to one. So it sounds like this simple fix, and it never turns out to be a simple fix. It always turns out to be something different. And all you can really do, in fact, you know, the last time we had this question on the Power Hour and John Walco was talking about it, he said he just converts his over with just a straight line from one tank to another just to eliminate this problem. So I never know exactly what configuration you have right now, but all we can really do is start at the tanks and kind of move forward until we figure out, is it a crossover line? Is it a valve, a junction? Are we returning fuel to both tanks? It always just requires getting in there and tearing things apart until we find it.
Yeah, the problem is it's a Volvo too, so they changed the fuel system on them a little bit too. It's an 05.
And that's what I mean. Every time we look get a truck, the fuel system, the configuration is just slightly different, and it increases the odds that there's one more component in there that can cause this problem. Like I say, it seems like it should be a really straightforward issue, and it never is. It's not one of those things that I'm going to be able to answer you on the phone. We just have to dig in and start following fuel lines and saying, could this happen? Is this junction the problem? Yeah, I wish I had a better answer, but this is just one that you got to dig in and get your hands dirty to figure it out. Let's see. You know what? We're coming up on a break. I'm going to take us into the break, and when we come back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. Do I need to remind you it's tax time? You know, I've been telling you this since last October. Are you tired of it yet? Because now it really is crunch time. We are 1 month away from filing taxes, which means every tax preparer on the planet is swamped. The odds of you getting in now and getting your tax return done by the 15th are getting slim every day. So don't put it off, because now what happens is every day you will fall further and further back in the line, which means you're going to get an extension, and then it's going to take even longer to get your final return. So get on this. Get on it right now. If you'd like us to do your tax return, we certainly can. All you have to do is give us a call. And you can call us for anything else you need as well. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. We'll be right back with more stuff. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to see how many I can get to here. Let's go to Wisconsin. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just wondering what the difference between a business and a personal loan would be, because I'm coming up on the end of my lease, and I have set away money for the buyout of the truck at the end, and I plan on buying it out, and I have the money, but I also was considering building a shed. So I was wondering, I don't have money for both of them, but if I were to borrow some money, would it make more sense to have a truck loan for the business or a personal loan for the other? Or is it just purely interest rates?
Just purely interest rates. Yeah, you got it. Whether they call it a business or personal loan doesn't really matter. And honestly, nobody at our level of business really ever gets a true business loan. So we could call it a business loan, but everybody is going to make you sign for it personally anyway. So they're going to still use your personal credit score. And if the business failed to pay the loan back, they would come after you personally. So it really doesn't matter. It tax-wise, it's meaningless. It doesn't matter whether your personal name's on the loan, the business, both. The interest is always deductible, because whether you borrowed the money personally or not, you used the money for a business purpose. That's what makes the interest deductible. So just however you can get the loan is the way you get the loan, and don't worry about what they call it.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's see. We're going to head off to Texas. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question on using your personal vehicle for business purposes and recording the mileage. Do you have to have the numbers off the odometer, or if you know it's 17 miles to town, you can just write that down, or how does that work?
You know, the IRS really wants two things on this. They want the total miles that you drove for business. So for that purpose, you could use GPS miles. You could know the trip and just write it down. You don't have to write down each individual odometer reading every trip. But the IRS also does want to see the total number of miles put on the vehicle for the year, business and personal. So the best way to do it is, you know what your odometer was on the first of every year. And then next year on the first, when you write it down again, then you can say, okay, I put on a total of 12,327 miles and 6,250 was for the business, and here's my log. But on that log for each individual trip, you don't necessarily have to have starting and ending odometer miles. That makes sense?
Oh, yes. I was hoping it was that way. It makes things easier. So, all right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And, you know, in today's world, we used to talk about a written, you know, log, and I would say keep a spiral notebook and a pen in your car. And today I would do it with an app. There are some really awesome apps out there for both Android and iPhone that do this for you. And most of them are written so that they follow the IRS guidelines anyway, because that's what they've written these programs for you to keep track of your mileage for the IRS deduction. Let's head off to Illinois. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wanting to get Road King shocks, and I was wanting to see if you saw value in putting them on the trailer also.
No. Yeah, I would only put them on the track. It'd be a tough argument to make on the trailer, and I'll tell you why. One of the big savings. So on the tractor, you get several benefits. One, the ride is awesome. You'll love the ride. And that, you know, it takes away a lot of vibration, a lot of the abuse your body's going to take, a lot of the abuse the truck would take. That's clearly a benefit. You're not going to get that benefit on the trailer. You know, that trailer really doesn't affect the ride much. You're not going to notice the difference back there. It's not like you're going to, you know, it's not like you're tearing up freight with your shocks and these are going to save you any money there. The other benefit is tire life. So when we put the Road Kings on and that tire stays in contact with the road all the time, we get significant increased tire life. So that could be a benefit to putting them on the trailer, but I just don't know that it would be cost effective to do that. Your trailer tires aren't as expensive. They don't last as long anyway, because they start with a lower tread depth. And I just don't think there's going to be enough tire savings on the trailer to really make it worth it. So we're losing one benefit. You're not going to notice the ride difference back there. And the other benefit I just don't think is big enough. But when we put them on the tractor, we get both the benefit of the ride improvement and the cost savings.
All right, I appreciate
it. You're welcome. Now, the other thing, I don't know if you were listening the other day, Road King now has their Silver Road line of shocks. I would put those on a trailer.
Okay. I forgot about that. I heard him talking about that.
That would be a good option because, you know, I don't think we could really cost justify the Road Kings. The Silver Road is a really premium shock, better than the OEM shock. It will extend tire life, not quite as much as a Road King would, but it would still extend tire life on the trailer. And we could make the argument that the silver road shock on your trailer would be cost effective.
All right, that sounds like a good idea. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, it really, almost all of our decisions really just come down to money. You know, is it cost effective? And if we know the numbers and we can calculate that, and that's kind of the case here. I just don't think I could justify. Now, we did put Road King shocks on our signature trailer. So, and the idea there was that was just a super premium trailer. We were doing everything we possibly could to improve fuel mileage and reduce maintenance cost overall. And I think in the long run, on the signature trailer, that made sense for us. But for me to say, yes, you should go out and buy these for your trailer, that's a tough call. I was really happy when Road King brought out the Silver Road shock, because it's just a nice compromise right in the middle. You know, we have the OEM shocks, which honestly are just junk. We have the Road King shocks, which are super premium, but they're pricey. And there was that big hole right in the middle of a really premium shock at a reasonable price. And that's where the Silver Road, and that's the new shock from Road King, comes in. It's right in that sweet spot for a lot of people. There are some people who really, I would say, should be putting the Silver Road on their tractor. If you've looked at the Road Kings and thought, no, I just can't afford those, they are cost effective if you can afford them. But if you can't, then you can't. And then the Silver Road shock might be a really good option for you. So check that out. If you're going to be at Louisville, they will have the new Silver Road shocks there, so you can take a look at them. Speaking of taking a look at things, I was going to get to another call, but I'm looking at the clock and I just don't have enough time. So I'll wrap this up and we'll do it again next time. If you haven't been to the website, you need to get over there. We have some awesome new products. It's letstruck.com. Look under the health store, and we have some awesome products for your bulletproof coffee. And we've been adding really healthy, nutrient-dense food that you can keep in the truck. My mission lately has been to find really good food that's truck-friendly. Our latest addition to the store is one of my favorites. We have a line of all grass-fed, grass-finished beef sticks. They have four flavors. My favorite is jalapeno. But these are, forget the health part of it right now, these are just hands down the best beef sticks I have ever eaten. The flavor's amazing. The quality is awesome. They're grass-fed, grass-finished, and fermented. No preservatives whatsoever. They'll shelf life in your truck for over a year. They don't take up a lot of space, and they're nutrient-dense. So they're also very reasonably priced for the quality. So go check those out. We also have Monkey Brittle back in stock. Better get that quick, though, because that never lasts long, and I don't know when we can get another batch of that. And all of our nut butters are there as well. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Ruff. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you back here tomorrow for Destination Health.